Support for the Front Row on FM 89.1 comes from the Community Foundation of West Texas and from Citibank. Citibank's wealth management team of advisors, private bankers, and trust officers help customers create personalized strategies to help connect with long-term goals. More information on Citibank Wealth Management is available at 806-687-2955. And from Texas Tech's JT and Margaret Talkington College of Visual and Performing Arts. Vast opportunities abound in art, music, theater, and dance. Dean Noel Zoller invites you to enjoy some of the 800 performances and exhibits produced each year by vastly talented students, faculty, and visiting artists. Texas Tech's JT and Margaret Talkington College of Visual and Performing Arts, vastly different. The Texas Tech University Opera Theater is presenting Mozart's The Magic Flute tonight, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon at the Lubbock Memorial Civic Center Theater. The conductor is a world-famous artist who has a long history with the magic flute, going back many decades through Europe and the Americas. He's our guest on the Front Row today. I hope you can stay tuned. On today's edition of the Front Row, we are at the Texas Tech University School of Music, where we have a very special guest with us today. Maestro Imre Palo is here to conduct the Texas Tech University Opera Theater production of Mozart's The Magic Flute. Maestro Palo, welcome to Texas.
Well, thank you. This is my first longer-term visit in Texas, and what mainly really just blew me away, besides the quality of the students, which I enjoy, the music students, but how kind people are. Wherever I meet people, wherever I ask questions, you know, being new, trying to find this, trying to find that, people are so polite, so helpful, that really sticks out anywhere else in comparison of anywhere else in the world.
Good. I'm glad you've been treated with respect.
Oh, yes.
I like that. Excellent. Well, tell us a little bit about you. You are from Hungary, is that correct?
Originally from Hungary. That's a long time ago, Clint. Long, long time ago. I left Hungary in 1961, when most of the parents of the students, and that bothers me, most of the parents of the students weren't yet born. Mm. Not even that the students weren't born, but their parents weren't even born. And went to study in Vienna. And so that's where my interest in music started. My father was an opera singer. I don't know if you are aware that my godfather was Zoltán Kodály, the composer.
Right.
So I didn't have a choice. It had to be music.
Yeah, right. So you grew up in a home with music.
Yes.
And in a home with opera.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. I mean, from my fifth, sixth year, my mother took me to the performances of my father. And it was interesting growing up, because as that young of a child, when I was taken to the performances, I didn't know that Don Carlos had a last act. I didn't know that Aida had a last scene, because my father was a baritone. By then he was dead.
Yeah.
He was shot dead or in Aida. And so I didn't know that Lucia had a final scene with the tenor.
Right.
Those were things which I found out when I grew up. So it was very interesting. That's how I grew up. And then from my teens, I then started going alone to the opera, and I didn't have to go home with my mother when my father was done. And that's when I figured out that there are also operas with endings.
Right. And
the Magic Flute I never saw with my father. So Magic Flute I kind of discovered on my own. My father was more a Verdi baritone. Mm. And somehow he found, and he always said, that the Mozart baritones were just a little bit too low for him.
Mm, mm-hmm.
So just those last two, three notes below C or below A, he wasn't that comfortable with it. So he really didn't frequent. He sang the Count occasionally in Figaro. But that was, I think, the only Mozart part he really sang. Not because he didn't want to, but vocally he didn't feel very comfortable.
Well, I'm fascinated by your history, not only as a conductor, but also in the opera, because a lot of conductors have said that working in the opera house had a profound effect on who they were as conductors general.
Oh, yes. Just realizing that you are working on two levels. You are working with the instrumentalists in the pit, so this is the lower level, so to say, as visual level, not as any other level.
Yeah.
And then the singers on stage, and you have to coordinate the whole group. But if you grow up with it, it's not a problem. Several conductors who mostly did symphony and had an unquenchable love and thirst of doing opera failed.
Mm-hmm.
Really doing opera, I really don't feel like naming names, but famous, outstanding, proven, wonderful musician conductors who eventually tripped over this two-tiered approach of the opera. I just didn't know it any differently. I got into symphonic music basically after I already established myself already as a grown-up in the opera. Not that I didn't study it or whatnot, but I didn't have a symphony orchestra until I was 30 years old. And then I became music director of a symphony orchestra in the United States. But my first love never stopped being the opera. That's just, the human voice has something to it which I don't think any other instrument, and I'm sure the instrumentalists would kill me for that. But somehow the quality and the fact that the human voice is really the performer is directly connected, so to say, to the instrument.
Yeah.
Any other instrumentalist, you pick up a violin and start playing, you pick up a cello, you pick up a piano. But the human voice is really part of your body. So it's a different relationship, I find, to music than anything else.
Right. Well, I've seen a list of the orchestras that you have conducted over the course of your career.
Yeah.
It's all the big, wonderful, fabulous names. You must have had an incredible life of incredible experiences with these musicians.
I was blessed. I was blessed, Clint. I really have to admit, I joined, when I left Hungary, I joined the Vienna Academy of Music and studied there with Hans Swarovski, who was at that time the, if I may say, flavor of the month as a conducting teacher. I mean, Zubin Mehta, Claudio Abbado, and so on and so on. Myself, of course, needs to be mentioned. We all went and studied with Swarovski.
Ah,
so that was the place to go. And yes, Swarovski was a wonderful teacher who taught us many important things. Where did I start? Where were we coming from?
All the experiences you've had as a conductor.
Yeah. And so I somehow was blessed to be always at the right place in the right moment.
Yeah.
And then also I was very fortunate that when I had the opportunity, somehow those were then the things out of which further opportunities developed. Just the fact that I was a shoo-in when I finished my studies in Vienna because I was coaching for Karl Böhm, for Karajan. I was a shoo-in to become a coach at the Vienna State Opera.
Yeah.
That was the thing, and I went there.
And you had piano skills?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
No, skills, no, but I played the piano.
okay.
No, the skills, no. But I played the piano, and I was good enough not to be kicked out, and I played Daphne for Strauss, Daphne for Böhm, and assisted Karajan in Salzburg with Trovatore and so on. So I could do those things. And then I went to the Staatsoper where they knew me already. I went there during my studying years at the academy as a sub to play for rehearsals. And it was done. It was a done deal.
Yeah.
and I delivered the worst audition of my life. Even if they wanted to, as much as they wanted to, they rightly couldn't take me. But as a result, I landed then a job in Germany in a mid-sized opera company in Wuppertal. Mm. That was my first job as a coach, but my goal was always conducting. So in Wuppertal, after the second year, I already got an opportunity to conduct an operetta, then to have my own production of Zar und Zimmermann, German opera. Wouldn't have happened in Vienna.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And luckily, in Wuppertal, these performances went well enough, so word spread to the next step house, which was Düsseldorf, which was already a major opera company, that there is a young, talented guy, maybe one should look at him. They came, looked at me, and I got a full-time conducting job. Within 4 years, I was a full-time conductor at the Düsseldorf Opera. And then in the Düsseldorf Opera, of course, the thing was, again, just like life plays, that it had two companies. It's called the Deutsche Oper am Rhein, mm-hmm. and they play Düsseldorf and Duisburg. Oh. So they have a bigger ensemble and they play two cities. As a result, I conducted 100-120 performances per season, which gave me the opportunity to really get comfortable doing what, because conducting is, you can teach it 100 times, you can explain it 120 times. If you don't do it, you don't learn it. It's a action and reaction. And if you don't have the reaction to your personal action, you don't learn it. So you have to stand there. You have to, as I said it in an interview in Bloomington, you need those 40, 50, 80 musicians who get mistreated by you. As a young conductor mistreats musicians because he doesn't know it better. It's not verbally mistreating. Just they don't have that technique and that ability to really conduct as well as more experienced conductors. But you need those years of mistreating those poor suckers to become a conductor. In my book, really a conductor, as far as mentally and humanly, 50 is where it starts. But you need the 30 years to arrive to it.
Yeah.
So that's what I had the opportunity. I went then to Düsseldorf and grew, and then suddenly I got an invitation to the New York City Opera in the 70s. I don't even quite know why Julius Rudell, who at that point was the director of the company, invited me. And I asked him, Julius, why did you invite? He says, I don't remember. But anyway, I went there. Again, I auditioned, they offered me to conduct a Butterfly. I never saw the orchestra, I saw the singers once, and I walked in and I conducted Butterfly. And somehow, it was a famous conductor, Clemens Krauss,
mm-hmm.
and he said that in a lifetime, a conductor has probably 4 or 5 occasions when God is sitting in the audience. And this performance, my audition at the New York City Opera, God was sitting in the audience. It really was. I joined the company, stayed there 18 years or so, and 18 years later, they were still talking about that Butterfly, and I did, among others, Magic Flute, but I conducted it a lot. And still, the musicians, the older musicians who remember, you know, these were all good performers, and did my own productions, told a start, and so on. They said, yeah, but that Butterfly. It was a charmed life. It is a charmed life. I still am doing what I love. Mm-hmm. I have my hobby for my profession.
And you're here to conduct Mozart's Magic Flute.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us, you mentioned that you had done it at the City Opera in New York.
Yes,
tell
I
us
did.
More about your history with the Magic Flute.
History of the Magic Flute started in the early, maybe 71, 72, in Germany, in Lübeck. That's where I first conducted Magic Flute. And then as a result, interestingly, I auditioned for two positions in Germany in different opera companies. Again with Magic Flute, no rehearsal, in I went. And I didn't get those positions, but I got other positions then. So it always went on. So I did the Magic Flutes then as a guest in Munich at Gärtnerplatz. I went in to conduct the Magic Flute. Got great reviews. Then where else did I do Magic Flute? Everywhere. Then I got to the City Opera, and Julius, we had a wonderful relationship. At one season we were talking about what is he going to do, what am I going to do. And he was doing Magic Flute. I said, you know, Julius, I just love that opera. I would like. He says, you know what? I'll do two less. You'll do two Magic Flutes. That's all. I did it at the New York City Opera in Bloomington, where I was a professor for 12 years. I think we did even twice within those 2 years, Magic Flute. It just always came around to me. And it's an opera which I just adore. In some of the numbers, you just feel like you are in heaven, really. Mozart at his really very, very best. And so when I was asked to do it here, I just got... Oh, I made my debut in Leipzig also with Magic Flute, exactly. And then went back, conducted there some more Magic Flutes and Abduction. So somehow my connection to Magic Flute is always nice. And I have so many remarks in my score, when to which dialogue cut. I have three orchestra scores of Magic Flute. I brought the one here, which is the lightest to travel with.
Right,
because
yes.
The other ones are heavy or bound. So I took this one, but there are also the things where are the cuts in the dialogues, mm-hmm. when to start the music, when the light goes on, and so on and so on. These are just remarks. But when I was asked, I was very happy to say yes.
I'm so glad. And we're so happy that you are here. Imre Palo, Maestro Imre Palo, is our guest today on the front row. Performances begin tonight, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and a Sunday matinee. And ticket information is available at selectaseatlubbock.com, and more information is available at music.ttu.edu. Maestro Paolo, thank you for your time today. I know you have an incredible schedule because you're teaching and you're rehearsing and you're doing the opera. So thank you for carving out some time for us.
No, that's all. It was my pleasure, and it's my pleasure being in Lubbock. I am coming back in end of March again.
Excellent. Great. We hope to see you then.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
Today's episode of our program will be on our website, kttz.org, later today. Rachel Boyd produces The Front Row. I'm your host, Clint Barrick. Thank you for tuning in and listening. Support for The Front Row comes from the Lubbock Symphony Orchestra, announcing the 2019-2020 season. More information is at lubbocksymphony.org.